For 35 years, it was the hippest trip on television. I'm John Schaefer, and today on Soundcheck, a look back at Soul Train and its late creator, Don Cornelius, who was known for his sign-off, Love, Peace, and Soul. World peace was the phrase Madonna left TV viewers with at the end of last night's Super Bowl halftime show. What did you think of her performance? We'll open the phones. Plus, classical violinist Ray Chen is releasing his first orchestral album this week. He'll give us a sneak preview and an in-studio performance. All of that on Soundcheck after the news. It was a Super Bowl that raised more questions than it answered. And that was just the halftime show. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Coming up on the show today, a look at the impact of the TV show Soul Train on American music and popular culture. And a live performance in our studio from violinist Ray Chen. But we'll start with the big entertainment at last night's Super Bowl. No question about who the best team in football is. Go Giants. But what about that halftime? It was kind of like an episode of Soul Train. Madonna had great dancers, outrageous fashion, and, yes, maybe some lip-syncing. We want to know what you thought of Madonna's performance. You can call us at 212-433-WNYC or leave a comment on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. Again, that number, 212-433-9692. And joining me on the phone is Eric Deggans, media critic for the Tampa Bay Times. Eric, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So, your take on the halftime festivities.
I think it was the most amazing karaoke performance I think I've ever seen. The visuals were amazing, and certainly it was a stage that was assembled in like 8 minutes. And it went through tons of changes. It looked really amazing. Of course, the choreography was mostly spot on. But I was troubled by the fact that Madonna didn't actually seem to be singing. She seemed to be lip-singing a lot. And I just think it's sort of a reflection of where we are right now with certain kinds of performers and certain kinds of artists where, Madonna's not, I guess, considered a singer anymore. She's not somebody who comes out and performs vocally live anymore. The thrill of watching her is seeing her execute all these dance moves. And for me, I still, call me old-fashioned, I still want my musicians to actually play music when they perform live.
Well, and it's funny that you say that, you know, she's not really a singer anymore. She's something else. When she unveiled the new song, Give Me All Your Lovin' or whatever it's called,
right,
the one where she name-checks herself repeatedly in the chorus, I just thought, well, this is branding. This is Madonna as a brand.
Madonna rhymed with Joanna. I mean, quite amazing lyrical wordplay there. And I think that song suffered by being sandwiched in between some of her best, most classic hits. So you hear a great song like Vogue, you hear a wonderful song like Music, and then you go into this song, which is frankly not particularly good and not memorable. And as you said, seeing more about sort of extending her brand and shouting to the world, I'm still relevant. Mm-hmm. I may be 53. I may be somebody that, people who are in their 40s party to when they were kids. But guess what? I'm still relevant. And, you know, frankly, if you are still relevant, you don't have to try that hard to look relevant. And I think that was another shortcoming for the show.
Mm-hmm. I thought she looked great, but she did also look like she was working awfully hard.
She was kind of out of breath by the end. I was on an earlier NPR show where we joked that they had a stretcher. They must have had a stretcher waiting behind the stage. And you know, it's easy to take pot shots. I mean, she almost fell over once or twice.
Right.
And that sort of thing. But, it's amazing that someone of her age, and I hate to sound condescending, but it is amazing that somebody in their 50s could look that good and dance that well and keep up with those young people. That is amazing. But I think it's time for Madonna to mint a new image for herself. a new voice for herself in her 50s.
Well,
I don't think she really needs to be the vixen who dances like an MTV video dancer anymore.
I think there was a little rebranding going on, especially of the song Like a Prayer, which she did with CeeLo Green. First of all, CeeLo, was he the best guest that she had out there?
I think so. The LMFAO dudes, it seems like they show up when a mall opening happens. I mean, I've seen those guys in so many videos and award shows and everything, you know. So that was nothing special. MIA, of course, you know, MIA was interesting. So rapper MIA comes in and performs a little bit. Really, she appears with Nicki Minaj and Madonna. She's the least known of the three. So, of course, she's the one who flips off the camera for a second during her performance, thereby ensuring that all the morning shows and all the morning news shows are talking about her instead of talking about Madonna exclusively. So it was a great public relations move. I don't know that it was quite a wonderful performance move.
Right.
And it was something I didn't even catch until I saw it replayed on the internet.
And you know, if it weren't for NBC's botched attempt to kind of cover it up, I think I wouldn't have noticed it either, because they sort of blurred the screen momentarily, and I thought, well, was there a little profanity? But no, it was MIA's middle finger. But here is Madonna with CeeLo Green and the halftime performance of Like a Prayer. Well, many people can remember when Madonna first sang Like a Prayer. There were all kinds of double... I mean, this was her at her saint-sinner, you know, at her most ambiguous, but
now,
it was all gospel
out,
last night.
I would just point out with CeeLo, that's what we call singing. That's not singing, that's singing. And then Madonna's vocal comes in, and you sort of realize why she's not really singing live.
Right.
But,
right.
Yeah, well, you know, I was holding out hope, even towards the end of her performance, that she might actually do Like a Virgin and dedicate it to Tim Tebow, but that didn't happen.
Oh, Eric Deggan's on the line with us from the Tampa Bay Times. Let's take some calls and see what some of our Soundcheck listeners think about yesterday's halftime show. Katie from Brooklyn, welcome to Soundcheck. Hi, Katie. All right, let's try Laurie on the Upper East Side. Laurie, you with
us?
Hi,
hello, thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure, what'd you think?
I loved it. I saw Madonna at Danceteria and Roxy in Studio 54 and years ago, obviously. And
yeah,
to watch the whole growth, I mean, just to watch what she's done, it's fascinating for me. But what I felt was, I was at this big party on the Upper West Side. There were all sorts of age groups there. And the younger people were kind of like, oh, she's like a little like Lady Gaga, you know. And it's sort of funny because it's coming full circle, sort of. And I saw Lady Gaga live, too. And here's what I think. I think that it's really spectacle. And if you had a body double up there that looked like Madonna, like, why does it need to be Madonna? It's the brand. It's a lot of big things like that for me. It was entertaining. I thought the new song was personally, I thought it was lame, and I thought it sounded like Katy Perry, whatever. I didn't like it, but the show was great.
Well,
yeah, I will say, you know, there's a reason why Lady Gaga plays so much keyboards and sings live during her shows and makes a point of saying that she sings live during her shows. I think it's her way of distinguishing herself from Madonna. And Madonna, if you've seen her recent shows, one of the things that surprised me about the halftime, and I'll just digress for a minute, is that in Madonna's recent live shows, she has deconstructed her songs quite a bit. The version of Vogue that she does in a 2008 video that she did in Buenos Aires was way cooler, way different, way more reimagined. And even though she's lip-syncing it, it's incredibly interesting, which is what surprised me about this halftime show. She didn't really change the songs that much.
Right.
But that's why, and Madonna has a section in her show where she talks about a guy that she's dating who's dealing with a girl who wants to be her. And then she has all these different images of her past, her material girl look, her original look on Lucky Star, and she sort of insults all those different past looks as a way of saying, you know, there are pretenders out there who try to be like me, but there's no one who is me. And I think that's another thing she's trying to do with this Super Bowl performance.
And in terms of the lip syncing, let's bring Katie in from Brooklyn. You with us, Katie?
I am.
All right. So were you surprised at the lip syncing?
No, actually, I think Madonna is such a spectacular performer. I think that especially after last year's Super Bowl catastrophe with the Black Eyed Peas, that the producers, they were correct in grabbing Madonna and saying, hey, girl, give it all you've got. We trust you. And she did.
What did you not like about Fergie and will.i.am and the rest of the Peas last year?
It was not a dynamic performance. She was off key, which doesn't really surprise me. I mean, they have fun pop songs, yeah. I guess, but overall, it just, you know, I expect Madonna. I expect Michael Jackson. I expect, you know, Aerosmith, maybe Britney Spears. Like, those are memorable, and I thought this was a memorable halftime.
All right, Katie, thanks very much.
You know, I would say there's one other thing about these halftime shows. There are very few sort of contemporary artists who are big enough to perform in a Super Bowl halftime. I mean, we talked about Lady Gaga, but try to think about somebody else in that league who could command a stadium like that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one reason why, when you look back, it's Madonna, it's Tom Petty, it's Bruce Springsteen, it's U2.
Yeah.
It's all these acts from the 80s and the 90s, because the modern acts, many of them are just not popular enough and not large enough, not great enough to really command a Super Bowl halftime.
And also they are a function of a very fractured musical landscape, no longer the monolith that it was when radio was the sort of the main medium for getting music. Now you've got the internet and the balkanization of music, and we've got comments on the webpage, and that means a trip into the control room with Joel Meyer.
John, these listeners liked what they heard. Betty Ann from the Upper East Side wrote, well, if it was an ad for modern medical science, I'm buying. Much like her songs, her face has stood the test of time. KP from New Jersey writes this. Let's see if anyone still knows who MIA is when she's 53. Another listener posted this. Being an old broad myself, I liked it, so sue me. And Sheldon from Brooklyn writes, Madonna clearly didn't feel comfortable dancing in heels. Perhaps she was afraid of falling. If she had worn sneakers, it would have been a totally different show.
Well, as it was, we didn't have sneakers, but we did, Eric, have the obligatory marching band, which seems to be...
Yeah, everybody does this.
The choir. We had a little bit of courtesy of MIA, a little bit of on-screen misbehavior. You know, anything genuinely new out there last night?
Well, at the end, again, the visuals were amazing. And at the end, there was a message about world peace that was spelled out in on the floor of the stadium. And I thought that was amazing. And I thought it was an apt metaphor for what we had just sat through, where the visuals and the look of everything was amazing. But the core of what you want from an artist, someone that you think of as a great, amazing pop singer, was not there.
Okay.
She wasn't singing, and there wasn't a lot of artistry on that level going on. It was all visual. It was all what you see.
All right. Well, and of course it was television, but Eric, don't go anywhere, because when we come back, we're going to go from the Super Bowl to Soul Train. We'll look back at the legacy of the late Don Cornelius and the musical show that changed TV history. Here's a little bit of that new song from Madonna that she unveiled last night. So a look at the history of Soul Train and the way it changed TV history. And then coming up later, a live performance from violinist Ray Chen. Stay with us for all of that as we continue with Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. This past Saturday, about 100 dancers staged a so-called flash mob in Times Square here in New York for about 45 minutes. Bewildered tourists watched these dancers form two lines and then take turns strolling down the middle of those lines, shaking their booties the whole time. It was a Soul Train line, the dance popularized on the funky TV show created in 1970 by the late Don Cornelius. Soul Train ran for 35 years, showcasing stars from soul, R&B, and later a bit of hip-hop. Cornelius died last week at age 75 in an apparent suicide. The show may not be on the air anymore, but to fans, Soul Train is still, as he used to put it, the hippest trip on television. And once again, media critic Eric Deggans of the Tampa Bay Times is with us. And Eric, was it for you the hippest trip on TV?
Oh, without a doubt, man, without a doubt. I grew up in Gary, Indiana in the late 60s and 70s.
The home of the Jacksons.
The home of the Jacksons, but more importantly, it was very close to Chicago, which is where Soul Train started. Mm-hmm. Soul Train was a local show for the first year of its existence before it moved to Los Angeles. And there was this sense that there was something kind of happening. You know, Gary had just elected its first black mayor. Berry Gordy and Diana Ross were coming into town to check out this great new act known as the Jacksons. And Don Cornelius had this show in Chicago where anybody who was had a career going in R&B music might be able to stop by and get on television in a way that they normally could not. And I think there was a sense that sort of black culture was busting out all over, and that finally we were getting a chance to show the world what we could do. And it was all kind of happening in our backyard. It was a really interesting and intoxicating time.
Now, when you watched Soul Train, who did you see up there when you watched Don Cornelius?
When I watched, well, you probably know I wrote a story about this mm-hmm. that was featured on my blog, The Feed, and also on the front page of the newspaper. I saw my father, and I saw a lot of men like my father who had grown up in the shadow of segregation and grown up in the shadow of Jim Crow and having to take second seat to white people for a long time. And then with the advances of the civil rights movement, all of a sudden they could be themselves and they could dress how they wanted and they could express their culture how they wanted. And they could do it in a way that was sort of proud. You know, that James Brown song, "I'm Black and I'm Proud." Muhammad Ali, you know, scoring some of his biggest victories at that time. The blaxploitation movies. There was a sense that sort of black pride and sort of black men were overcoming in ways that we'd never seen before. And I think Don Cornelius, a guy who unquestionably owned his own show, ran his own ship, and was giving so many opportunities to other black artists, he was sort of the epitome of a huge part of that.
Well, and in this clip from Soul Train, this is James Brown. So this is, you know, an iconic figure in black American music. As his, I'll call him his hype man, points out in this really amazing introduction.
Are you ready for the Super Brother music for the soul? He's black and phonic. Heritage and funky music for the third world. Ladies and gentlemen, doing it on his good foot, Super Brother himself. He's got a bag of his own. Ladies and gentlemen, Soul Brother number one, James Brown.
J. James Brown on Soul Train back
good
in
God.
The 70s. Yeah, good God. And now, after that intro...
I kiss myself.
You hear that, and you just start talking like that.
But you hear that intro, and does he come out and sing, I'm Black and I'm Proud? No, he comes out and he sings Hot Pants. But that, too, was part of the James Brown experience.
He'll get to I'm Black and I'm Proud. He'll get there.
How revolutionary was Soul Train?
Well, what Soul Train did was a couple of things. Number one, it brought sort of contemporary black culture, black pop culture, to television. Mm-hmm. This was still a time when, Soul Train started in 1970, and it was nationally syndicated in 71. So this was still a time when black folks would see black people on television and run to their phone and call all their relatives and say, hey, there's a black person on television. I mean, that's how rare it still was sometimes to see, black folks on television. And at that time, maybe we had I Spy, we had Julia, we had some other shows. But at that time, the black people that were on television often didn't feel like black folks from the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. They were white versions of black people. They might as well have been white, but they were played by black people. Soul Train brought authentic black people and authentic black pop culture to television. So part of it was just exposing that to the world. And then part of that was us seeing it. Black folks seeing that our pop culture was cool enough and slick enough and impressive enough to actually be on national television in a way that white pop culture, white youth culture, already had been for years and years with American Bandstand and mm-hmm. with Ed Sullivan and what have you. And then finally, black culture was getting that same showcase.
Well, and then what happened is you have that black showcase not just appealing to the black community, but to a white community as well. I can tell you my own experience is very similar to that of Susie from the Bronx, who writes this. As a white chick from the Bronx, I watched Soul Train for the dance moves. Well, that's not my experience maybe, but this part. I remember waking up hungover Saturday morning to catch David Bowie. Bowie was pretty messed up, which became evident during the Q&A session. But anyway, there's Bowie. There's Elton John. You've got, the first inklings of Blue Eye Soul coming onto American television sets through Soul Train.
Right. Well, that was an interesting time, and that time that she's describing was probably 5 or 6 years later when we hit the mid-70s.
Right.
And Gino Vannelli was the first white artist to appear on Soul Train, and after that, they started welcoming other white artists, Elton John and David Bowie among them. And that was a time when I remember listening to WGCI, which was the heritage black focused radio station in Chicago, and they would play Joe Jackson, for example. They'd play You Can't Get What You Want because it had a funky bass line in it and it was relatively danceable.
Mm-hmm.
Fame by David Bowie got played on black radio stations because it was kind of funky. It was an environment where if a white artist did a song that was kind of funky, black stations would still play it. Ironically, many years later, 30 years later, radio stations are so segregated now that you would never see that. Good luck seeing. I mean, I think, for example, "Wanted Dead or Alive" by Bon Jovi is kind of a funky tune,
But
you would never see an R&B or hip hop station play that song unless somebody remixed it.
Back in May of 1975, Elton John appeared on Soul Train to sing "Benny and the Jets."
Together, the spotlight's hitting something that's been known to change the weather. We'll kill the fight and cough tonight, so stick around. You're gonna hear electric music, solid walls of sound. Oh, kind of around, I haven't seen them yet. But they're so spaced out.
John did Benny and the Jets live on Soul Train, May 17th, 1975. Eric Deggans of the Tampa Bay Times, TV and media critic, with us on Soundcheck today. And Eric, it's pretty obvious that he is performing this live.
Yeah.
What about the live versus lip sync thing?
Well, that was a momentous thing for Soul Train, because having artists lip sync was cheaper. Frankly.
Right.
So, but again, you know, when the show got really popular and they were looking for ways to change things up, one of the things they did was they had some artists come in and play live. And I got to say, you know, at that time I was learning how to be a musician. I've been a drummer for 30 years now, and I really appreciated being able to see artists play live on television. It is hard for younger people to imagine, because every artist is a mouse click away or a smartphone app away. But back then, you had to really work to find and see artists that you loved performing live on television. There weren't that many shows that featured them. Often they were very late at night, and often they lip synced because it was cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
So when Soul Train started to have live performances, you know, James Brown playing live, Sly and the Family Stone playing live, Cameo playing. You got a chance to see these amazing bands and see how they actually made music, which helped you when you were trying to make music on your own as well.
Now, what about, you know, as we head on through the era of hip-hop and the growing domination of hip-hop, Don Cornelius didn't really have a whole lot of room in his musical thinking for it, but he had to sort of, you know, make some room for it on the show, because it was such an important part of the culture. How did he sort of fight that kind of internal battle?
Well, you know, one of the things that I think is kind of interesting about Soul Train's journey is that Soul Train's journey, as I said before, is also the journey of a very specific generation of Black America.
Mm.
So I do think that Don was always sort of like the older uncle who might let you take a swig of Cavassier at the family luncheon. You know what I mean? He was always that cat who was, he's the guy who would get out all his favorite records and put them on the phonograph so that the kids could go downstairs and dance to him. He always had that vibe. So he was never like one of the kids who was dancing, but he was always sort of the older patriarch who would help things out. When rap came along, though, it was so, I think, tough for a time for older generations of Black folks to deal with that music, you saw the rift. And he really was so removed from that generation that he couldn't really, I mean, he admitted himself that he didn't really understand rap and he didn't really like it.
Mm-hmm.
And, there's a great scene in the Soul Train documentary that VH1 aired where they showed a clip of Don Cornelius introducing, I think it was Curtis Blow, and sort of admitting that he didn't like the music and he didn't get it, but it's his job to put it on the TV, so that's what he did. And he said it,
whoa,
like while the guy was standing there. And
well,
later
these
showed,
are the breaks.
Exactly. And later they showed an interview with Curtis where he sort of said, you know, I felt my heart drop because I couldn't believe that he would say something like that. But Don was always, a relatively straight shooter, and he couldn't really hide the fact that he didn't like rap. He didn't understand it. And Black pop music was going in a direction that he really couldn't relate to. So, rap became sort of a really big force in pop music in the early 90s, and by 1993 he stopped hosting Soul Train.
In 1988, on Soul Train, Heavy D, the late Heavy D, did the Overweight Lovers in the House. That episode also, by the way, featured Lou Rawls, who would have been more to Don Cornelius' liking. We've been remembering the late Don Cornelius and his historic TV show Soul Train with Eric Deggans, TV and media critic for the Tampa Bay Times. Eric, nice speaking with you again.
Thanks for having me.
This is Soundcheck. So gently I kiss her, twist her in her ear, and tell her that I miss her. She might try to pop that boyfriend junk, but I don't really care because I know he's a punk. I'll stop him like a roach if he tries to approach. Still to come, virtuoso violinist Ray Chen stops by for a live performance in the Soundcheck studio next. The This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. When Ray Chen was 3 years old, his parents gave him a toy guitar, which he promptly stuck under his chin and tried to play with a chopstick. Since then, the now 22-year-old violinist has won some major international violin competitions and picked up some instruments with serious pedigree along the way. He just released his first orchestral album, which you're hearing in the background, the Tchaikovsky and Mendelssohn Violin Concertos. But today, he joins us here in the studio to play a couple of works for violin and piano. This is Ray Chen with Pablo de Sarasate's Introduction and Tarantella live on Soundcheck. Thank you. The wild applause. That is music by Pablo de Sarasate, and it would have been written for just that kind of occasion, to get the crowd roaring in approval. Ray Chen performing his Introduction in Tarantella live in our studio with Julio Elizalde at our piano. Ray, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
Boy, you did just dive right in. First piece out of the box, and you go for one of the big virtuoso showpieces by the Eddie Van Halen of the violin. I mean, this, right down to the two hand on the fingerboard technique.
Yeah, some finger tapping there, yeah.
So what is this violin that you're playing here in the studio today?
Well, I'm lucky enough to be playing on a Stradivarius. It was made in 1721, mm-hmm. and it's called the Macmillan. And it was through a young concert artist that I have this generous loan of this instrument.
Young concert artists every year, you know, they do these kind of, they call them auditions. It's basically like a competition. So
right.
you won that a couple of years back.
Yeah, back in 2008.
And part of that is you get concerts and management stuff. Usually you don't get an instrument out of the deal.
Well, no, this was somebody on the audience happened to hear me and then decided, you know, that they liked me enough and wanted to support me. So mm-hmm. that's how it came about.
So generally when we see violinists playing not just a Strad, but one of the named Stradivariuses, the ones with a pedigree, with a history, generally they're loners, right? Someone else owns it and you're sort of playing it for a couple of years.
I mean, with the price that the price tags on them right now, which can go for anywhere from a few million to, I mean, over 10 million. I mean, we've seen some of the sales that have been going on recently. I remember one of the lady Blunts just went on, you know, for like 15 million or something like that, something incredible.
That's also a Strad.
Yeah, that's also a Stradivarius.
Now, you saw the article, you blogged about it, the article where they did a study of violinists, blindfold sort of taste test
yes.
thing,
yes.
three modern violins
right.
and three Strads and Guarneris, right. and really the violinists couldn't tell the two apart.
Well, you know, in my blog, yeah, that kind of bugged me a little bit, and I have to say that the test was done in a hotel room. I mean, come on, let's be honest here. When I you know, tried a new violin, I don't go to a hotel room mm-hmm. to you know, test the sound.
Right.
That would be like having a Ferrari and testing it in a car park. You know, you just don't do that. and then, you know, I mean, yeah, a few other factors that I thought made the test a little bit unfair was the fact that, I mean, who knows that there were great instruments, of course. I mean, these Strads and Dalgases, but when was the last time they were played? I mean, I think they came from a museum and weren't played for many, many years, perhaps. And that's when you don't do that. After 6 months of not playing an instrument, it'll go to sleep. It'll start to go to sleep and the sound will just kind of go away. And then it takes some time to revive the sound again.
And new instruments will have a similar period. I mean, we have a newish piano downstairs in the green space, which is now 3-4 years old and is only now beginning to really open up.
Right,
you know?
Right.
I mean, these instruments are made of wood. They're organic materials.
That's right.
So they respond to heat, humidity, and as you say, to being played or not being played.
Right, the vibrations mm-hmm. from the sound through the instrument. That's so important.
Yeah. So you hear the difference.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and I think it also takes someone who's, you know, experienced having played, you know, great instruments such as these to know what a great instrument actually sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've got a great instrument on the new recording, your first orchestral record, the Tchaikovsky and the Mendelssohn. Now, these are, you know, thrice familiar works for classical music fans, but they mean something personal to you, don't they?
Absolutely, yeah. These two concerti have been, you know, kind of like my war horse concertos. In 2008, I won the Yehudi Menuhin International Violin Competition with the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto. And then in 2009, I won the Queen Elizabeth International Violin Competition with the Tchaikovsky. So, you know, I've, you know, naturally when the the question came up, what do you want to record? I said, well, I want to share these two works with the audience, with the public, as soon as possible. So, you know, I feel like they still have this kind of excitement, this energy. And these two concertos are not, you know, you can play them when you're young. You don't have to wait, I think, like something like Beethoven, you know, they say, well, you're supposed to wait until you're like 50 or something.
Well, Ray Chen has recorded both the Tchaikovsky and the Mendelssohn violin concertos with another up-and-comer, the conductor Daniel Harding, and the Swedish Radio Symphony Orchestra. Just a little bit of the Tchaikovsky violin concerto, the first movement. That is just a little bit of Ray Chen's recording of the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto in D, paired with the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto in his new recording, his first orchestral effort. He's here with the pianist Julio Elizalde in our studio this afternoon. And you're going to play some music from the world of Hollywood next.
That's correct.
Although John Williams, when he wrote the score to Schindler's List, he had the violin and a particular violinist, if memory serves, in mind.
That's correct. He wrote it especially for Itzhak Perlman. So this piece from theme from Schindler's List is, has the violin in mind, and that's the first, you know, priority of it.
All right, let's hear a live performance in the Soundcheck studio. Ray Chen is the violinist. He is playing here in New York tomorrow night at the club known as Le Poisson Rouge downtown. That's at 7:30. But playing for us with Julio Elizalde at our piano here in the Soundcheck studio, it's music from Schindler's List by John Williams. Thank you. Music from the film Schindler's List, music by John Williams, played live in our soundcheck studio. Ray Chen, the violinist, Julio Elizalde at our piano. Ray's most recent recording is an orchestral one, the Tchaikovsky and Mendelssohn violin concertos, playing here in New York tomorrow night at Le Poisson Rouge, which is, Ray, a club more associated with, you know, kind of the downtown music, jazz, rock, post-rock scene than classical music.
Right, right.
Making a statement by playing there?
Well, I think it's, it's classical music is such an has such a cliche of, you know, being uncool and, you know, something like that the average, you know, young person wouldn't go to. But I think Le Poisson Rouge, this club, is doing a great
service.
Deed by doing this and having classical music being played there like on a regular basis.
Right, right.
Like Emmanuel Lax and Hilary Hahn, these kind of people.
Well, now, you know, when you look at the 18 to 24 demographic, which, let's face it, any kind of music would love to have these people going to their concerts. In terms of classical music, the group here in America that has the most sort of attendees of classical concerts are Asian Americans. There was an article in Slate recently.
Yes, I saw that.
You saw that?
Yeah.
14% of Asian Americans between the ages of 18 to 24 had been to a classical concert in the past year, way more than any other group in that age range. Now, you're born in Taiwan, raised in Australia, but you're now based here in the States.
That's correct.
Do you feel, I mean, when you were growing up, was classical music important to your family? Did they make it important for you?
Well, I mean, since I started violin at such an early age, it was kind of always a part of my life. But I must say that, you know, it is interesting. Most Asian families will kind of encourage their children to take up an instrument. And I think this is, you know, great for just, you know, just educating them. Even if they won't become classical musicians in the future, you learn so much by, you know, learning an instrument. You've learned the discipline of, like, kind of practicing, responsibility of taking care of your instrument. And, I mean, these skills just take you, you know, far in life.
Well said. And then we've got like 20 million kids studying piano in China alone. So when people sort of bemoan the future of classical music, are you fairly optimistic about it?
I mean, I think, yes, I am. And I've seen the audience and, you know, it's always a great pleasure to hear the words, you know, oh, well, usually this isn't our typical audience. But when you came, there were so many more young people. So I think really the artist represents the audience that's there. So, you know, that's something to think about.
Ray Chen, the violinist. His new recording is the Tchaikovsky and Mendelssohn Violin Concertos, and he's been playing for us here in the Soundcheck studio today. Ray, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And that's going to do it for Soundcheck today. On our next program, speaking of kids growing up in Asia learning how to play music, one of the biggest pop sensations in Korea recently made its debut on CBS's Late Show with David Letterman, the 9-member vocal group known as Girls' Generation. So tomorrow, the music known as K-pop gets our genre patrol treatment. Also, a live performance from the Juno-nominated Canadian band, Bahamas. And it's just 1 week until we kick off our Super Collectors series, and we want to hear from you if you or someone you know has an absurdly large collection of music-related stuff, memorabilia, concert tees, magazines, rare instruments. Let us know by filling out our nomination form on the Soundcheck page, wnyc.org/soundcheck. Our technical director is Irene Trudell. Our engineer today, Paul Schneider. The program produced by Katie Bishop and Greta Cohn. Our senior producer is Joel Meyer. We had help today from Ellen Walkington. I'm John Schaefer. I will leave you with a little bit more of the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto in Ray Chen's recording. This is Soundcheck. Thank you.